Well, let us turn once again this evening to the Acts of the Apostles, and in chapter 17, and we want to look at a certain statement that we find in verse number 6, in Acts chapter 17. But we'll read verses 6 and 7 simply to get the general content and context. This is Paul at Thessalonica. He's been preaching, or he is preaching totally, for 3 Sabbaths. There were Jews which did not believe, we're told at verse 5. And they took unto them certain lewd fellows of the baser sort, gathered a company, and set all the city in an uproar, and assaulted the house of Jason, and sought to bring them out to the people. And then at verse 6, we read, and when they found them not, that's Paul and his companions, they could not find them. They drew Jason and certain brethren unto the rulers of the city, crying, those that have turned the world upside down are come hither also, whom Jason has received. And these all do contrary to the decrees of Caesar, saying that there is another king, one Jesus. I want to draw our attention this evening to this statement, a kind of a description. It is a criticism. It is certainly not a complimentary utterance that we find in the final words of verse 6. These that have turned the world upside down are come hither also. The apostle is on his second missionary journey. The Christian gospel is spreading rapidly through the ancient world, the ancient Mediterranean world, and it is obviously creating a stir, and it is seen to be a mysterious power, the gospel, which is turning men completely around in their life and in their thinking. And it is becoming increasingly an alarming reality to the Jewish hierarchy, and even to the civil authorities in the Roman Empire. And we read this as we go through the Acts of the Apostles. We find that wherever the gospel was proclaimed and took root, people were never the same again. There was a certain divisiveness. There was a certain separation that was inevitable when men began to hear and embrace the gospel. You were either for it or you were against it. And in this chapter, we find the Apostle Paul, as was his custom, going into the synagogue, preaching as he always preached, and the response was predictable, and it was inevitable. It's the same kind of response over and over again. But what our interest is in this verse this evening is the way that the crowd, who were not favorably disposed to the gospel preached by the apostle, the way that they describe Paul and his companions. These men that have turned the world upside down are come hither also. And this actually is a good translation. There are some versions which would translate it rather differently. They would say that these men that have upset the world, or upset society, or some such thing. But this is a very good, accurate translation, because the word literally does mean putting things on its head, so to speak, turning things around in the very opposite direction in which men were accustomed to go. These men that have turned the world upside down are come hither also. And there's no question that when we read through the Acts of the Apostles, one of the astonishing things is the success of the preachers of the gospel. We recognize, of course, that not everybody who heard the apostles' preaching became a Christian. It may well be the case that most who heard the gospel did not become Christians. But nonetheless, the fact of the matter remains that wherever the apostles went, there seemed to be many, many people following and believing their message. Even in Athens, at the end of this chapter, we're told that there were a few people who believed. But the point is, they believed. The apostles were not preaching in vain. They saw fruit for their labours. They were not only faithful preachers, they were fruitful preachers. And I'm emphasising this because this is in stark contrast to what we see in our own generation. We can think of times in the not too distant past where we read of revivals, we read of the establishment of churches, we read of very, very fruitful ministries, growing congregations, increasingly Christianity influencing society and even governments. And we don't seem to see that same thing today. And there may well be reasons for that that we really must take home to our own hearts. But our interest this evening is the way that the gospel and the preachers of the gospel are described in this particular utterance in verse number 6. And it's such a stark and such a striking description, critical though it is, that I think it's worth our while to consider these words. These men, not the men, but the message that they preached, has turned the world upside down. Now they've even come to us. This is the substance of what is being said. So as we look at these words, let's begin by emphasizing the word world. These men that have turned the world upside down are come hither also. Now, the word that is normally used for world in the Greek New Testament is the word cosmos. And that means the creation. It also means society. God so loved the world. The men of the world do not love the world, says the Apostle John in 1 John chapter 2, for example, at verse 15 to 17. Do not love the world. And obviously he means the society of the world, the way the world is organized. But the point is that the word that is used for world here is not the word cosmos. It's a word that means the inhabited world, the world that is a kind of a household, the world where men live together in a particular kind of way, a particular kind of society. And undoubtedly, when the word is being used here in this very context, it obviously means the Roman Empire world. It means the world that was familiar to the Jews and to the Greeks and to the Romans at that time, because that was the extensiveness of the gospel. And obviously these men are recognizing that their world has now been, as it were, invaded or in many ways interrupted in its normal course because something new has come into their world, such as they have never heard of before. This word world, for example, is used in chapter 24 in the Acts of the Apostles, at verse number 5, where we're told there, "For we have found this man a pestilent fellow and a mover of sedition among all the Jews throughout the world, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes." This was the accusation, you remember, levelled against Paul by the Jewish authorities in Jerusalem when he was apprehended there and sent for trial. This man has been upsetting the whole world. It's the word that is used in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 2 at verse 1, you remember, where it says, well, looking at it, chapter 2 in Luke's Gospel, where we have the, "And it came to pass in those days that there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed." All the Roman world, the civilized world, the world that imagined that all wisdom and all knowledge and all prosperity was limited to the world that they knew. And undoubtedly it was a very successful world in many ways. So this is the implication of what the words are saying to us, is that this gospel was a very public affair by the time Paul came to Thessalonica. It was being gossiped about. People were hearing about it. And there's no question whatsoever, surely, that these men in Thessalonica, they would have heard of Paul's ministry in Philippi, for example, that we read about in chapter 16 in the Acts of the Apostles. And they would have heard, no doubt, of the conversion, the beginning of the first Christian church in Europe, actually, the Philippian congregation, the very first European congregation, and the conversion of Lydia and those that were associating with Paul in that place. And then, of course, the famous dramatic conversion of the Philippian jailer. And how you remember in Thessalonica, Paul and Silas had been imprisoned because the preaching that they were preaching was upsetting many in Philippi. And you remember how the magistrates at the end of Acts chapter 16, they urged Paul and Silas and the others to depart. Please leave Philippi, because wherever you go, there is this kind of upsurge and this kind of civil disturbances following the preaching of the gospel. That's the background. But this is the world where men live. It's the kind of world in which we live. It's the world where men rule, where men make laws to rule. It's the world of men's philosophy, men's traditions hold sway in such a world as this. Men's philosophy, men's worldview, how they see the world, their rational thinking as they try to understand the world in terms of science and all the other associated ventures to try to make sense of the life that we live and the society in which we live, to try to understand ourselves. That's the kind of world that is in view. And we do know from the writings, especially of these ancient Greeks and Romans, we know a great deal about them. We know a great deal about them because they wrote about themselves. That's why we know. We know more about what these people were like, the kinds of beliefs that they held. We know their names. We know when they were born. We know when they died. We know where they lived, because they were writing about it. There's a whole corpus of literature has come down to us from these ancient days. It's generally called the classics. And they are a vast, vast volumes of information concerning people and places, doctrines, traditions, the philosophies of the day, the religions of the day. We know what kind of religions they had because they tell us what kind of religions they had. In later on in this chapter 17, in the Acts of the Apostles, we come across the two major philosophies in Athens at the time, the Epicureans and the Stoics. They were the two main philosophies. They were the ones that held the sway among the people. You were tending to be an Epicurean, or you would probably be a Stoic, one or the other. These were the main ones on offer, we might say. The whole educational system ruled by men, the whole world view according to the way that men think about things. And this, of course, leads to a certain harmony in the world. It leads to a measure of agreement among people. People are able to trade prosperity and peace. And there is no question that the Romans were very great peacemakers in a sense. The Pax Romana, wherever they were, they established peace because they brutally suppressed any opposition. It was one of their own writers, one of their own historians, Tacitus, who wrote that the Romans, or he was reporting what the subject people were saying, the Romans make a desolate. They make a desolation. They make a desert. They fight a war. They make a desolation and they call it peace. But peace it was after a kind. And there is no question that people begin to settle into the Pax Romana, because as long as you lived according to these rules and regulations, the Roman Empire would in fact look after you and defend you and so on and so on. So life has to be lived on a measure in which men agree together to live in a certain kind of way. And we are familiar with that. The politics of our own age demonstrate that. Nations differ. The extreme right wing on the one hand, the extreme left wing on the other hand. But if you're there, that's the way things are done. That's the way to get on. That's the way to be able to trade and to make a kind of prosperous living. That's the world that is being held up here. These men have turned this kind of world upside down. This does not mean, of course, that when we say that men live in this kind of world, this doesn't mean that they are necessarily perfectly happy in this world. It means that they put up with it because it is possible. And it means that to change the world would create too much of a revolution, too much of a change, that it may well be that you end up with something even worse than what you've got already. And that's always the danger of revolutions. They tend to be worse than that regime that they replace. So here is the world into which the gospel is thrust. To the Jew first, always where Paul went, we're told he went into the synagogue after his manner was, and out of the scriptures on the Sabbath days, he would point the congregation to the person and to the work of the Lord Jesus Christ. So this is what we're to understand about the world that is in view here, the world that has been turned upside down by the gospel. The only way that such a world is ever going to be changed, and everybody knows this, is some kind of revolution in thinking, a new way of understanding. And the Romans understood that. They had kings in their early history, then they became a republic, and then they became an empire. Julius Caesar, we know, was executed by his friends because they thought he was wanting to be a king and restore the ancient monarchy in Rome. They were determined never again to have kings over them. And so the way of thinking, it's the way people think that changes the way people live. And the communists understand that, and everybody understands that. So it is always a new way of thinking that turns the old world upside down. And it's against that background that we are to understand the coming of Paul and Silas and their companions and the preachers of the gospel in any place and in any age. They come with a message that is designed, deliberately designed, to turn the world upside down. So the first thing then is the world. The second thing that we emphasize is this message of the gospel that alone can turn, really turn, the world upside down. Why so? Well, the gospel is a challenge. The gospel is a message that challenges every single human institution without exception. I can't think of any human institution at all that is not challenged by the gospel, challenged to change, challenged in its priorities, challenged in its practices, challenged in its ambitions. The gospel is in the world as a continual challenge to the world. That's the point, and that is what is clearly revealed in the Acts of the Apostles. This does not mean, when we say that the message of the gospel is transforming, turning the world upside down message, we do not mean that it is a revolutionary social reform that is emphasized in the gospel. I'm emphasizing that because reforms generally are of a political or a social or an economic challenge and a change. Revolutions. The gospel is very accommodating, in a sense, to the present activities of society. We can think, for example, of the institution of slavery, which was commonplace in the ancient world, in the Roman world, in the Greek world, and in places in the world even today. And we find over and over again that there is no attempt made by the preachers of the gospel, nor even by Jesus Christ himself, to overturn the institution of slavery by some radical revolutionary means. There are other institutions which were inherently unjust and cruel. The treatment of children, for example, women also, did not have the rights and the liberties with which women in Christianized societies have. And there is no mention that the preachers of the gospel went into any society and they preached against the status quo, so to speak. We do not find the preachers of the gospel speaking against the emperor, for example, as such. They didn't go into Thessalonica and begin to speak against the Emperor Augustus. They accepted the political situation as it were. They accepted the government that was in power, and they recognized that the powers that be are ordained of God. It was God's purpose for that time and place that there should be a Roman Emperor Augustus, and that the reign through which these apostles were ministering the gospel, the rule was an empire reign. No democracy there, no way in which you put the people to a common ballot, not in Rome at this particular time, not even in Greece at this particular time, although in the past the Greeks had a public plebiscite where they would make up rules. Women were not included in the voting system. The slaves were not included. It was free-born citizens in the Greek cities alone. But nonetheless, there was a kind of democracy. And we do accept that democracy, it is probably true to say, was invented by the Greeks. And they thought it was a good way of dealing with the life of the polis. But the slaves and those non-Greeks were to play no part, and women were excluded from the public assemblies also. So the Christian preachers, they did not go into any society and immediately look around, point out all the faults and all the weaknesses of the society. They saw the society as it was. As Paul was waiting at Athens, we're told, he saw the false religions and the statutes, as it were, on every street corner. He recognized that here was a city which, for all its wisdom, all its beauty, its philosophy, its learning, and its rich, rich history, for all that, it was a city steeped in darkness. And he did not attack, as it were, simply the institution of Epicureanism or Stoicism. He preached to them the God of the Scriptures. And this is the point. The apostles did not go and simply accept things as they were. They didn't tell the people in Thessalonica, who were Greeks, after all, but they were under the dominion of Rome. They did not tell them to rise up in arms against Rome. Our Lord Jesus Christ did not tell the Jews when he was ministering in his earthly ministry to take up arms and join in the rebellion. And there were many rebellions. The Gospels don't mention them all, but there were many, many insurrections against Rome. The Jews hated being under the oppression of Rome because they knew way back in Moses' teaching there was the great teaching for the Jews that if they had followed God's ways, they would never be under the oppression of any heathen power. And yet here they were under a heathen power, and they felt that it was their religious duty to God drive out the heathen power of Rome. Jesus never encouraged that. He never spoke about it. He never preached about it overmuch. He had a completely different message. And so when we hear of these men turning the world upside down, it's not because they set out to turn the world upside down as such. They didn't come to destroy things. They came to change things. They came with a better offer. What they were offering in the preaching of the gospel was something that was better. The gospel is an offer of a better alternative to every religion, every political system, every social system, every government. The gospel is a continual offering to the world of something that is ultimately and infinitely far, far better than anything they have ever imagined, ever invented, and ever practiced. That's the issue that lies behind these words, these men. It is offering something that is to replace the present status quo, but what is going to be replacing is far superior to what is going to be removed. And this means, you see, this is the implication of this, that when these men who came to Thessalonica, they've come here also, they have come not simply, as it were, to preach another religion, which is to stand alongside every other religion to be found in the Roman and the Greek world. They have come with a deliberately evangelistic message. The gospel is evangelism. The Christian faith is by nature a proselytizing faith. It is a faith which sets out to win others to Christ, to win the hearts of people. And I'm emphasizing that because there are some religions in the world and they're not particularly evangelistic. The Jewish religion, for example, is not particularly proselytizing. It never was. That was the tragedy. That was one of the failures. It was meant to be. They were meant to be a light to the world, but they were not a light to the world. They kept their religion to themselves, basically. If somebody wished to join them and become an Israelite, then they were welcome to come. The teaching of Moses emphasized that. But they had to become Jews, as it were. They had to be circumcised and keep the ceremonial law and so on. Eat the food, wear the clothes, and observe certain days and so on. They had to become, as it were, like the Jews. The Buddhist faith, for example, is not particularly an evangelistic faith. If you wish to become a Buddhist, one who is an adherent of the Buddha, then by all means they would tell you how to go about it and point out the Eightfold Path, but they're not going to force it upon you. They're not going to take the initiative. If you wish to come and join them, you're welcome, but they're not going to go out of their way, as it were, to invite you and to plead with you. But in the gospel, when Paul and his companions went, wherever they went preaching, they went with a message. When Paul went in to the synagogue in Thessalonica, or any synagogue, he would not simply say to the gathered Jews to carry on as they were doing, carry on with their Jewish ritualism and their Jewish understanding of the scriptures. No, he would challenge them. He would tell them, he would emphasize what he always emphasized. Look at verse number 3. Paul was opening and alleging that Christ must needs have suffered and risen again from the dead, and that this Jesus, whom I preach unto you, is the Christ. And we have the same thing repeated again at verse number 7, whom Jason hath received, and them and these also do contrary to the decrees of Caesar, saying that there is another king, one Jesus. They went against Caesar, as it were, but they were reminding the people, emphasizing that there is a king who is higher than Caesar. That was a political, dangerous thing to do. And we find it also in the 16th chapter, when Paul and his companions were at Philippi, you remember, read verses 20. At verse 19, pick up the reading at verse 19 in Acts chapter 16. And when our masters, that's the girl, you remember, who was prophesying by that demonic spirit, and Paul cast it out, and the demon came out that very hour. And when our masters saw that the hope of their gains was gone, they caught Paul and Silas and drove them into the marketplace unto the rulers and brought them before the magistrates, saying, these men, being Jews, do exceedingly trouble our city, and they teach customs which are not lawful for us to receive, neither to observe, being Romans. They are teaching us to live in a certain way which it is not lawful for us as Romans to do, because they are teaching us to worship the God of the Jews. Whereas in the Roman religion, Caesar was the one who was regarded as a divine ruler. And you poured your incense onto the altar of Caesar, and you were to say, Caesar is Lord. Your allegiance was not to the gods of Rome, your allegiance was to Caesar, to the emperor. You took an oath to Caesar, and you expressed it in a religious ceremony. That was something that would keep the peace in Rome, and it was something that held the Roman Empire together. And it was when that Caesar worship began to decline, actually, in the matter of history, it was at that point that the Roman Empire began to unravel, because the centre was no longer holding in that one confession throughout the Roman Empire of all true Roman citizens, Caesar is Lord. Here are men with a message saying that this Jesus, he is Lord, he is the King, and it is not lawful for us to hold to that. But nonetheless, that was the thrust of the gospel message, and that is always the thrust. And I think that there's a great danger in evangelizing by criticizing, being contemptuous and critical, far too much of everybody else who differs. And I do feel in the Reformed faith, and those of you who study Reformed books, you will have to concede that what I'm saying is accurate, that when you find apologists for Protestantism writing and preaching their sermons and their books, you find them inevitably bringing up the Church of Rome, finding out, criticizing what the Church of Rome does. I've been reading recently through a well-known systematic theology, and the number of times that the Roman Catholic Church is brought up in all its faults, it is absolutely astonishing. Why not simply emphasize the Christian message? Forget what the Church of Rome teaches for a while. Yes, we understand that they go astray here and there, but we don't have all truth either. But the point is, the apostles did not, as it were, simply go and preach the faults of all the other alternative religions. What they did was they preached a positive message concerning the person and the work of Christ. And this takes us to the point that I'm emphasizing now. These men have turned the world upside down. But what world was it that is turned upside down before the world of men can be turned upside down? And the question for you and for me is this: has our world ever been turned upside down? Because the change that comes through the preaching of the gospel and receiving the message that Jesus Christ is Lord, he becomes our King. This is not simply a change in society, an outward change of life. It is a change in the innermost hearts of our inner life. It is people who are changed. And when people are changed, then the society in which people live are changed. Christianity changed society. Christian countries began to abolish slavery long before any other country did. Why? Because simply through the transformation that comes when we become converted to Christ, it is seen as an obvious thing that that slavery is an abomination to the Lord, despite some apologists to the contrary. There are those who support the Confederate States of America, and they say that they looked after the slaves very well. And many of these men who held slavery in their power, they were professing Christian. They were good churchmen. Wherein is slavery an abomination? It is an abomination because you shall love your neighbor as yourself. You shall even love your enemy as yourself. As myself, I'm a free man. That means I must make sure that my neighbor is a free man. If I am hungry, I eat. If I'm thirsty, I drink. If my neighbor, even my enemy, is hungry or thirsty, I give him food and I give him drink. If he's naked, I give him clothes. I look after my neighbor with the same kind of care as I look after myself, and yet keep him in chains, work him like an animal, feed him on subhuman nourishment, own him, lash him, beat him, treat him as a chattel. Of course, when people are changed, life is changed. Why is Australia in the parlous moral swamp condition that it is today. Because Australians are like that. This is the kind of people who occupy this land. Godless, immoral, and all the other things that characterize a godless nation are simply an expression of the hearts of the people who inhabit that nation. Why was it that the Roman Empire was a cruel empire? Why? Because the Romans were cruel people, that's why. Why was it that the Greeks, for all their culture and all their reason and all their philosophy and all their moralizing as the Stoics did, why was it that they approved of slavery? Why did they practice sodomy? Why? Because that's the kind of people they were. And they would continue to be like that until there came a turning upside down in their own life, where their minds were changed, where their morals were changed, when their affections were set on things above, where they began to look at the world not through the eyes of mere temporal prosperities, but when they began to look at the world through the eyes of Christ and through the eyes of God. The mind of Christ is the great turning upside down of any individual's world. And the question for us is, have we experienced this? It is all very well to be living the upright moral life, to be living the religious life. The Romans were religious people. The Greeks were religious people. They had gods many and lords many. They had many religious practices built into the society of their godlessness. Their religion was godless, immoral, unrighteous. And it takes the inward change. And it's all very well to be seeking to live as a Christian, but the basic issue remains, have we ever been made Christians in the first place? The New Testament teaching is addressed to Christians, men and women, boys and girls, who are assumed to have had their world turned upside down by the preaching of the gospel. And sometimes this comes in very small manners. Think of the parables that Jesus spoke about. The kingdom of heaven, the citizens of the kingdom. They become citizens of the kingdom because a little leaven has been implanted into their lives and it spreads. The mustard seed has been planted. The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed. It is like the pearl of great price, where you're looking for meaning in life, recognizing that there must be something somewhere of great value, surely. And then you come across it. The man walking through the field, perhaps accidentally kicking a stone, and there underneath he saw a pearl that he recognized as being what he's always been looking and longing for in life, the pearl of great price. And at that moment, his world is turned upside down. And he goes and he sells all that he has in order to obtain that one pearl of great price. The new birth is the turning of our world upside down, because we are transferred from the kingdom of darkness into the kingdom of light, into the kingdom of God's dear Son. We are translated. We cease to be the old man in Adam. We become new men in Christ. So radical is this turning of our world upside down that we become, as it were, a new creation. It's as radical as that. The new birth is the beginning of a new everything. And the turning of our world upside down must begin with this radical message of the gospel. Repent, believe, take up the cross, follow me. And when that is embraced, then our worlds are turned upside down. Nations can be influenced. There has never been in the whole history of the world a Christian nation. There have been nations that have been Christianized more than others. We acknowledge that. And we like to call ourselves as a Christian nation. And even today, my native land in Scotland would still be regarded as a Christian nation. But it is not regarded in Scripture as a Christian nation. Neither is Australia. Neither is the US of America. We could multiply examples. There's no such thing as a Christian nation where everybody is truly one whose little world has been turned around and upside down by the gospel. There are those nations, of course, where there are more Christians than others, but they never outnumber those who are not Christians. But you can have a Christian home. You can establish a Christian educational system in a nation where God is recognized as being important, of supreme importance. We recognize that there is no such thing as Christian mathematics, but there are mathematics that can be pursued for the glory of God, and laws, establishing laws. And there is no question that over the centuries that followed the preaching of the gospel, as the gospel spread throughout the Roman Empire, and more people embraced it individually and personally, their lives were turned about, and so things were changed. And eventually, in the 4th century, the Roman Empire itself embraced, by and large, the message of the gospel and became a Christianized nation. And so it became a popular thing to be making a profession as a Christian. And that began the long ruin of the church. Of course, we must pray for this change. We must pray for our nations. We must pray for our rulers. We must pray despite the apparent lack of transformation in their lives. Could it be that this nation of Australia is as it is because it is not hearing the gospel, because men are not going into the nation preaching the gospel? When you listen to church men speaking, what do you hear? Platitudes, moralisms, hand-wringing. Where do you hear throughout the land the loud clarion cry concerning the sufferings of Christ and the glory that should follow, and that he is king? That alone is going to turn the world upside down. That alone is going to turn the church around from its backsliding and turning the nation around. It's the same principle everywhere along the line. But there's something else that we should keep in mind. We've spoken about the world inhabited by men. We've spoken about the gospel coming into the world as a challenge to all men and to all societies and all activities in the worlds of men. We've emphasized the change. It takes place in the heart. Our world, our heart must be turned upside down. And only then will we be turned around in every other way. But the final thing I emphasize is this, just as we close, and I'm going to close in a moment. The opposition. The opposition, continual opposition. Now, is this opposition that we find in these words of our text this morning, is it because the Romans were opposed to all change? No, they were not. They were willing to change. They were always on the lookout for better ways of doing things. And were the Greeks willing and unwilling to change? No, they were always listening to new things, we're told, when Paul went to Athens. These philosophers, the Stoics and the Epicureans, they were quite willing to learn some new thing. And if they could improve upon their present philosophy, then they'd be willing to add to anything worthwhile that Paul might say. It's not change as such that the world opposes. It is this change that the world opposes. It is the change that has to do with Christianity and Christ. It's not the old habits that bind us to the past and to the present state of things. It's not simply that old habits die hard. That's not the problem. It's the old nature. It's our depraved nature that resists the change. We don't mind changing. We like to change our governments from time to time, to go from left wing to right wing, from right wing to left wing, and then down the middle at times. So we put in governments because we're looking for a change. But not this change, the change that these men have been preaching and that has transformed their days and many lives. Christianity is too hard. Christianity is not easy. Becoming a Christian is not a cinch. It's not something you could do just with, as it were, a few little tweaks here and there. It's the whole world that must be turned around inside us. And that's difficult because we don't want to change. We don't want to be too radical. We don't want to be too extreme, taking up the cross. Yes, we will say that, but we won't practice it overmuch because it's too difficult to do. The offence of the cross, the offence of Christ. It's too hard, as the commentators say. C.S. Lewis, when he's speaking about mere Christianity, I think I've mentioned this to you before, he has a chapter, is Christianity easy? And he argues very strenuously the difficulties of being a Christian. Christianity is not easy at all. Being a Christian is not an easy thing. It's very hard because the old man doesn't want to be a Christian. We want to go to heaven, but we don't want to walk the narrow road and enter by the narrow gate. It's too hard. It's too high. The ideals are too high. It's a holy life. It's a heavenly life. Jesus Christ is the King. There is another King, Jesus, the King of a heavenly kingdom, different to everything with which we are familiar. You see, Christ at the end of the day is the real offense of the gospel. The world doesn't mind Christians as long as they keep their mouth shut and don't stand up. But the moment that we reveal Christ, at that point we become targets. And that's when the offence and the trouble starts. And that's when it started at Thessalonica. There was a riot and Paul and Silas were urged by the brothers to leave for the safety of their lives. The offence is the offence of Christ. And yet still, despite all this, and on this I must really close down, Christ is offered. He is the offence to the fallen world, but he is offered to the fallen world, and he is offered in love because God is concerned for the world and he recognises it is a good thing for the world to be turned upside down. Is Christ finally going to win the fallen world? No. Is there going to come a time when the whole world is going to be, as it were, falling into the ways of Christ? No, we don't believe that. The Bible doesn't teach that. What is going to be the end, finally, of the world that refuses to be turned out upside down by the gospel? What is the end result? The end result is destruction. And any individual who refuses to be turned upside down by the gospel, and any society, any government, is destined for a final judgment, and lost opportunities lead to a lost eternity. That's the implication of what these preachers were all about. And that is what we're to pray for. And that's what we're to do what we can for. And that is what we are to try as best we can to speak about to men. Because God's gospel is a powerful gospel. And there is nothing going to change the world. There is nothing going to change the minds of a corrupted world. But the power of the gospel presented, the suffering of Christ, the glory that should follow, the kingly rule of Christ in our individual lives, nothing less is required, and nothing else will do duty for this great revolution, the upheaval of Christian conversion and commitment. That's what lies embedded in these words in Acts chapter 17 at verse number 6. These men, they have turned the world upside down. God grant that we will see such things again. May God bless his word to us.